Well, here at Radio 3, we're about to launch a week of programmes about the music and culture in five capital cities in Europe on the eve of World War I. Music on the Brink. To accompany that season, Michael Barclay's guest today in Private Passions is the novelist Pat Barker.
As we begin this new year with the commemoration of the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War, it's appropriate that my guest today has perhaps done more than any other writer to explore the war and its terrible losses. For 20 years now, Pat Barker has been writing about that period of our history in prize-winning books like the Regeneration Trilogy and recently in Toby's Room. Some of her characters are real historical figures, like the poets Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen, and the books are based on a quite staggering amount of historical research. But you said, Pat, I think, that for you the First World War is not just history. It's very much to do with your own personal story.
Yes, I think that's because I was brought up by my grandparents. And, of course, for them, the First World War was their war. And my grandfather had been badly wounded in the war. He had a bayonet wound in his side, and every Friday night he used to get ready to go to the British Legion for his weekly pint, and he used to get stripped off and get washed at the kitchen sink. So I would look at this bayonet wound, and I actually remember as a very small child poking my finger into it, because it was nothing like the kind of wounds you get after surgery. It was a very deep scar. And I never asked him what it was, and later on, of course, I realised. But when I realised that it was a bayonet wound, I took it almost for granted. I thought that's what you got if you fought in the First World War. Whereas, in fact, bayonet wounds were extremely rare. Shrapnel or bullet wounds were the common wounds. And the only reason, in fact, that he had survived a bayonet wound was that he was an officer's batman, and the officer shot the man who stuck the bayonet in, before he had time to twist and withdraw. And the twisting and the withdrawal, of course, were what did the damage. Worst damage. Mm.
So, from childhood, war was very much surrounding you and perhaps coloured the way you developed as a writer.
I think inevitably. I think a writer's themes really are set in the first 20 years, and that's a generous estimate. I think possibly in the first 13 or 14 years of your life, and I suspect the same may be true of composers and artists as well. Early themes are embedded and not within your conscious power to change, probably.
And what difference do you think it made to you being brought up by grandparents rather than your actual parents?
I think it gave me access to a world which is outside most people's living memory. I think the fact that my grandparents and my great-aunts were alive and kicking long before the First World War, and their memories went back into the 1890s, and they would all sit around and talk about it and argue about it and quarrel about it. So you got very much the impression that that past was still alive and still mattered.
And we're going to hear music that is quintessentially First World War, filtered through Joan Littlewood's controversial but rather powerful musical Oh, What a Lovely War from 1963. Do you remember that quite vividly?
Very vividly. I was there, not on the first night, I think, but I was there during the first production, and I was a student at the time, and I couldn't get a seat, and there were a number of people. It was absolutely packed. There were a number of people standing at the back, which I imagine is completely forbidden now. You don't see people standing at the back of theatres. And, you know, Walter Badgett said the English are a deferential people. Well, I was privileged to be there at one of the events at which the English stopped being deferential.
Out of a kind of rage.
Yes, a kind of rage, but she didn't want to portray death or suffering. She wanted people to leave the theatre laughing, not feeling pity. She wanted them to be disgusted by the vulgarity of war.
watched you playing cricket and every kind of game.
At football, golf and polo, you men have made your name.
But now your country calls you to play your part in war.
And no matter what befalls you, we shall love you all the more.
So come and join the forces as your fathers did before. Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go. For your king and your country both need you so. We shall want you.
Gas the night before. Gonna get gas tonight if we never get gas anymore. When we're gassed, we're sick as we can be. 'Cause phosgene and mustard gas is much too much for me. They're warning us.
One respirator for the four of us. Thank your lucky stars that three of us can run. So one of us can use it all alone. Bomb last night, and bomb the night before. Gonna get bombed tonight, if we never get bombed anymore. When we're bombed, we're scared as we can be. Oh God, stop the bombing planes from High Germany. They're over us, they're over us. One shell hole for just the four of us. Thank your lucky stars, there are no more of us. 'Cause one of us can fill it all alone.
Gassed last night, and before that we heard Your King and Country Want You from the original cast recording of Joan Littlewood's Oh, What a Lovely War. Do you feel that the element of bitter satire that is in the musical found its way into your writing to some extent?
Maybe. I don't see myself as a satirist, honestly. I think I'm more concerned with the horror and the pity. Mm. Though I do think the satire, of course, is a very valuable weapon. You know, Siegfried Sassoon used it brilliantly, of course.
With your childhood, there was a kind of mystery at the heart of it, wasn't there?
Yes, because I simply don't know who my father was. I don't know anything about him. I was told when I was a little girl that he died in the war, which was by then, of course, was the Second World War. The reason for this, I think, is all tied up with the conditions of life at war. My mother was in the Women's Royal Navy, and she was very much in love with a young man who was torpedoed. And she was grief-stricken. And after a few months of moping around, her friends said to her, look, you've got to snap out of this. Let's all go out and have a drink. And they had a drink and another drink and another drink. And at some time in the course of the evening, my mother met my father. And that is all I know. And she was terribly ashamed of it, poor woman.
Yes, because at that time, it was so much stigma.
It was a great disgrace for the mother and to some extent even for the child. And I would love to be able to say to her now, you know, it really doesn't matter.
And in your writing, there's quite often a father figure or a search for a father figure.
Very frequently, I think, and it can be absolutely horrific and disastrous. The little girl in Union Street, for example, latches on to a strange man as a father figure, and he turns out to be a paedophile. At the other extreme, of course, Siegfried Sassoon latched on to William Rivers, his doctor at Craig Lockhart, in exactly the same way, and saw him as a father figure. And although that wasn't also entirely a beneficial relationship, Sassoon was always very grateful that he had met Rivers.
I mean, it's rather extraordinary that a whole generation of fathers, as it were wiped out.
And what a massive scale it was on, especially after the First World War. I mean, I give readings sometimes, and I talk to old people who are the children of the men who died in the First World War, by them now themselves very elderly. And, you know, more than once somebody has come up to me and said, I now understand what my father went through, and I know why he was the way he was while I was growing up, because nervous disorders were extremely widespread and they caused a lot of disruption in families for decades after the war.
And the awful thing is that some people were shot by their own side because of nervous disorders.
Yes, indeed. I mean, a lot of the people who were executed for cowardice were probably suffering from shell shock. There's a particular grave in France which has haunted me, and the War Graves Commission have planted a very large rosebush across it, because what it says behind the rosebush is good riddance. Yeah. And that is a father disgusted by the cowardice of his son.
I don't know about you, but I find even just sort of driving through that part of France with all those names like Vimy Ridge is profoundly moving. And of course, if you go to the cemeteries, it's almost overpowering.
Mm. And it's amazing the way in which the names of the places stand for an enormous weight of emotion. You know, you run out of words. One of my characters, Billy Pryor, says you run out of words. And in the end, the names are left to say it all. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very true.
So you were brought up by your grandparents, basically, yeah. Weren't you? It meant that you were probably very au fait with the culture of an earlier generation. And, of course, that included music hall.
Yes, and one of my earliest memories of music is my grandfather singing a music hall song and doing all the actions with it, because that was his party piece when he was a little boy in the 1890s. It's an incredible link through. And, of course, if you're going to be a historical novelist, extremely useful.
It is 10 weary years since I left England's shore, in a far distant country to roam. How I long to return to my old native land, to my friends and the old folks at home. Last night as I slumbered, I had a strange dream. It seemed to bring distant friends near. I dreamt of old England, the land of my birth, to the heart of her sons ever dear. I saw the old homestead and faces I love. I saw England's valleys and dales. I listened with joy as I did when a boy to the sound of the old village bells. The log was burning brightly. The night that should banish all sin, for the bells were ringing the old year out and the new year in. Home, home, sweet, sweet home. At the door of cottage we met face to face, for the first time for 10 weary years. Soon the past was forgotten, we stood hand in hand, father, mother, and wandering tears. Once more in the fireplace the oak log burns bright, and I promised no more would I roam. As I sat in the old vacant chair by the hearth, and I sang the dear song, home sweet home. I saw the old homestead and faces I love. I saw England's valleys and dales. I listened with joy as I did when a boy to the sound of the old village bells. The log was burning brightly. Twas a night that should banish all sin, for the bells were ringing the old year out and the new.
Weren't afraid of sentiment, were they?
The Miner's Dream of Home. We heard the popular bass baritone Peter Dawson in a recording he made a few years after he returned home to Australia from serving in the war. A song for your grandfather,
Pat
Barker, remembering Home Sweet Home in Thornaby-on-Tees in Yorkshire. What was home like life for you then?
I had a very happy childhood, in spite of the missing father and the unmarried mother and all the problems relating to that. It became slightly less happy when my mother married, because I missed her very much and I went on living with my grandparents. And I didn't get on particularly well with my stepfather, though it has to be said his own children didn't either. But once again, it's another accident of war. He was in the trenches at 15. He was gassed. And he never really worked again. He was disabled and in pain and bad-tempered, which is understandable.
Your grandparents, for a while, ran a fish and chip shop, didn't they?
Yes, they did. That, in fact, was in Knaresborough. We moved around in Yorkshire a bit and then went back to Teesside.
And one of your ambitions in your writing, I think, has been, this sounds rather grandiose, but I know, I'm sure you'll understand what I mean, to do justice to the speech and the stories of the people that you grew up with. And there's a kind of Laurentian aspect to your writing in that way.
Yes. I mean, I think my childhood was quite unusual in the sense that my grandfather was profoundly deaf and didn't speak much, partly because conversation was difficult. My stepfather had a paralytic stammer, and the women never stopped talking. So it was very much a matter of talkative women and silent men. And actually the books tend to follow that pattern too.
You won a place at a grammar school, and that was in a way a ticket to a rather different world. And I think it was then that you began to listen to classical music.
Yes, and I started to play the cello. And I played it excruciatingly badly. And I gave it up when I moved schools because there were no music lessons in my next school. But it's a valuable experience even so, because nothing makes you appreciate music being played well than making a horrific racket yourself.
Well, even just understanding how the strings work and the open strings and the stopped strings gives
yes.
you enough more insight into what people who really
into
can
be
doing.
What people are doing and how bloody difficult it is.
and so you've chosen the wonderful Elgar Cello Concerto and that famous Jacqueline Dupré recording. Of course, I mean, this has been a popular piece for some time, but that recording really put it onto a different trajectory, didn't it?
Yes, because it was an unlucky piece, wasn't it? It had a terrible opening and wasn't played very much. Mm. And then suddenly it took off round about the time as memories and understanding of the First World War also changed dramatically. And this is a piece very linked with the First World War, of course, with his Elgar's own sadness over it.
It's interesting that so many of the artists around that period, and I mean not just writers, obviously writers like Houseman, Kipling, you know, lost people and had felt very bitter about it, but also, as you say, composers like Elgar. And what a lot of people, I think, don't know is that he really resented the fact that one of his tunes was used as in a jingoistic way,
yes,
Land of
yes.
Hope and Glory.
Yes.
So, shall we hear Jacqueline Dupré? You probably saw her play this on film, if nothing else.
Yes, I certainly did.
And yeah. Very moving, wasn't it?
Extremely.
Do you feel it sort of taps into something quintessentially English?
I think it does. I think it taps into that feeling for that war and the sadness of that. But what really fascinates me about this piece is that the melody was composed immediately after we recovered from a general anaesthetic. And I think that is amazing. Also, we're going to hear Britain later on, and Britain's fascination with the world of dreams and the part that dreams play in inspiration. But I'm just amazed that general anaesthesia can apparently do the same thing.
Do you ever dream up ideas?
I do dream up ideas, and I have once had an idea after a general anaesthetic, so Elgar was not the only one.
Jacqueline Dupré, playing the Adagio from Elgar's Cello Concerto in the famous recording with Sir John Bobbirolli and the London Symphony Orchestra. Now, Elgar composed that cello concerto in 1919, in the aftermath of war. From his cottage in Sussex, he'd listened at night to the pounding of guns from across the Channel.
It's often forgotten how noisy the bombardments were, that the worst of them used to shake teaspoons in saucers in South London. I think that has been forgotten.
That lost generation, as you've said, included so many poets and composers. And we're moving on now to hear perhaps the most famous of them, the poet who was killed in the final week of war, what a terrible thought that is, Wilfred Owen. And you made Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon central characters in your Regeneration trilogy. Did this feel risky, mixing real people and invented characters?
It felt very risky indeed with Wilfred Owen, who is not only well known and had letters and poems left, of course, but also came with kind of legend attached to him. No, he came trailing clouds of glory, as it were. If I could have waved a magic wand and removed him and not had him at Craig Lockhart, I would have waved the magic wand, but, you know, he was there.
So Craig Lockhart was the hospital where Rivers treated
where
people.
Where Rivers treated and where Siegfried Sassoon was sent after he protested against the war. And there he met Wilfred Owen, who was there being treated for shell shock.
We're going to hear two poems, and this is a lovely idea, and thank you for it, by Wilfred Owen, read by Anton Lesser. First, Dulce et Decorum Est, and then Apologia pro Poemate Meo. Why have you chosen these two, Pat Parker?
I choose the first one, I think, because it ties in with the Gas Last Night song at the beginning. The other one I like because it's a side of Wilfred Owen that not many people recognise. It's the side that was ambiguous about warfare.
Ambiguous, ambivalent in what way?
There is a sense in which in that poem he feels it is a great privilege to be a serving soldier, to have had that experience. And he represents the soldiers as a band of brothers who are united completely and who, in fact, despise the civilians.
Dulce et decorum est. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind.
Gas! Gas! Quick, boys!
An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire, or lime, dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea. I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell, with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Apologia pro poemate meo. I too saw God through mud, the mud that cracked on cheeks when wretches smiled. War brought more glory to their eyes than blood, and gave their laughs more glee than shakes a child. Merry it was to laugh there, where death becomes absurd and life absurder. For power was on us as we slashed bones bare, not to feel sickness or remorse of murder. I too have dropped off fear behind the barrage, dead as my platoon, and sailed my spirit surging light and clear past the entanglement where hopes lay strewn, and witnessed exultation. Faces that used to curse me, scowl for scowl, shine and lift up with passion of oblation seraphic for an hour, though they were foul. I have made fellowships, untold of happy lovers in old song, for love is not the binding of fair lips with a soft silk of eyes that look and long. By joy, whose ribbon slips, but wound with war's hard wire, whose stakes are strong, bound with the bandage of the arm that drips, knit in the webbing of the rifle thong. I have perceived much beauty in the hoarse oath that kept our courage straight, heard music in the silentness of duty, found peace where shellstorm spouted reddest spate. Nevertheless, except you share with them in hell the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell, you shall not hear their mirth. You shall not come to think them well content by any jest of mine. These men are worth your tears. You are not worth their merriment.
What I find fascinating about the first poem in particular is that it moves from being a very vivid description of an actual experience to a nightmare, to the same experience being reenacted in nightmares. And of course, nightmares were the characteristic symptom of shell shock. Siegfried Sassoon said that the Craiglockhart War Hospital was a very cheerful and happy place by day, but at night the doctors lost control, and all you could hear is screams and cries as men went back to the terrible experiences of the front. And so it seems appropriate that Benjamin Britten, in the next piece we're going to hear, a piece which is about dreams and the way in which dreams colour waking life, that he should have set a Wilfred Owen poem as part of the cycle.
And she is.
That was Benjamin Britten's setting of Wilfred Owen's poem, The Kind Ghosts, the sixth song of his nocturne. And we heard Ian Bostridge in a recent recording with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. By the way, all the details of the Private Passions music are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. It's disturbing, that strength of bitterness, of contempt, and contempt for the nation at home, in a way, too.
Yes, it's interesting that the rhetoric of warfare is all about national unity, but the reality is often very different. And certainly in that war, I think soldiers almost came to feel a hatred of civilians. For the women who were handing out white feathers, some of them at least. You know, for the old men who were sending the young men off to die. And for people in cushy jobs in munitions factories. They hated the lot of them. I did feel, actually, after that particular sequence of poems and music, that what we could really do now with a really bawdy, cheerful, jolly song from the men at the front. Unfortunately, we couldn't find them. I'm sure they were singing them, but the bawdy ones have not been preserved in print, unfortunately.
Well, next, a composer who in many ways was a kind of musical counterpart to Wilfred Owen, and that's George Butterworth, a stunningly gifted young man, I think. And he went off to war more or less knowing he wouldn't come back, didn't he?
Yes, I think so, and he destroyed his compositions, a lot of his compositions, before he went, perhaps because he didn't want to leave what he thought of as half-baked compositions behind him.
And hadn't been able to revise them.
Yes.
I don't think he has a grave.
No, he doesn't. He died on the 5th of August 1916 on the Somme, and his men buried him very hastily in the side of the trench where he was killed, and the area came under very heavy bombardment subsequently, and his body just disappeared. Either there was nothing left or there was nothing left that was identifiable, and he's one of the names on that apparently endless list of names on the Thiepval Memorial. And he is one of the great what-ifs of the war. What would he have done if he'd survived? What would Wilfred Owen have done? But also, of course, what would all the other men have done too? Some of whom were so young that they hadn't managed to write a single poem or do anything else that they might have wanted to do. I love the piece because it's a young man's music. He was only just 31 when he died. And it seems to me to be full of joy and optimism. It seems sad to us because we know what happened to him, but I don't think there's any melancholy in the music.
Thank you.
The Banks of Green Willow by George Butterworth. The Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. I was very struck by something, Pat, you said when you won the Booker Prize in 1995. The Somme, you said, is like the Holocaust. It revealed things about mankind that we cannot come to terms with and cannot forget. It can never become the past.
Well, yes. You know, when you look at you see filmed versions, television versions of the War Requiem, and almost always a picture of those battlefields or Paul Nash's depictions of those battlefields, and there's also the Holocaust, these dreadful pictures of human beings being shoveled into mass graves. And, you know, we did this because for me this is not at all about nationality. Mm. It's not about the British and the Germans. It's about what we as a species are capable of. And I think we must never, ever forget that we were capable of that, because remembering that is our best hope of not doing it again.
So it doesn't surprise you that, as in regeneration, for example, men were so traumatised that they were paralysed and couldn't speak, couldn't move hardly.
No, and that especially that was tended to be the common soldiers, who were even more completely helpless than the young officers were. And yes, I think silence, you know, in the end, silence, speechlessness, is the natural reaction to some of it, but it's also the reaction that has to be overcome.
And is the act of remembering therapeutic in itself?
It's necessary. You know, at the National Memorial Arboretum, there are blank panels left for the dead, for the names of the dead of future wars. Now, if you look at war memorials, you see the names of the dead of the First World War, and squashed in below them, the names of the dead of the Second World War. There was no space left for the dead of future wars, because there wasn't supposed to be one. And we have switched to having blank panels. And to a certain extent, war has become, once again, an accepted instrument of policy. And I think that has to be challenged, and I think it is being challenged. I think people are becoming increasingly sceptical, and perhaps the urge to memorialise the dead of this war and all the wars is part of that growing scepticism. I like to think it is.
And can fiction, and in a sense I include Britain here, can fiction say things that factual history in a sense can't?
Well, for one thing about factual history, of course, is it does tend to focus on the movers and shakers, on the great names. And even social and economic history is focusing on classes and members of social institutions of one kind or another. I think the great thing about fiction is it focuses on the individual with all his peculiarities and all his hopes and fears and what happens to him. And that is what needs to be remembered always.
We're going to end with a work that is inspired by religion quite clearly. And yet for so many of the people that you have spoken about, they could not conceive that there could be a God, given what they had seen.
Well, you know, I'm not religious myself, in spite of the religious bent of some of the choral music I choose.
It's unanswerable in one way.
It's unanswerable. But if you look at, you know, the Holocaust or the Somme battles, why would you lose faith in God rather than in man? Mm. It seems to me that the real temptation is to lose faith in man.
Mm. Well, it's the dream of Gerontius that you've chosen, and more Elgar, and it's the priest's chorus after the death of Gerontius. What is it about this that you particularly like? I think you listen to this music when you're working sometimes, don't you?
No, I listen to it before I work. I can't listen to music while I work, because it's like having another voice in the room.
It demands attention.
It demands attention. I need absolute silence when I'm working. But sometimes if you've had, you know, the bills and all the usual minutiae of life, you need something to create a space in which you can create. And that is where music is absolutely brilliant. And this is one of the pieces, because I defy anybody to listen to this and not want to get up and do something.
Thank you very much, Pat Barker.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh,
Elgar's Dream of Gerontius, the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle, with the soloist John Shirley Quirk. And all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, along with a download of the programme. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Next week's guest is the singer Rufus Wainwright.